It is good to see everybody here this morning. I would like to extend my own welcome to our visitors that we have today. And again, if you are visiting with us, and please fill out a visitor's card. You'll find that in the rack in the pew right in front of you. There will be a time during our worship service, both during this segment and later on, where you'll have an opportunity to fill out that visitor's card and place it in a collection basket. We do encourage you to do that so that we can give you some contact, some gratitude, so that we can tell you how much we appreciate that you've been here. And that if you have any needs at all, then please let us know. We'd love to sit down and have a Bible study with you. Now, our kids have been through quite a bit lately here at Monte Vista. They've done a very, very good job, though. There have been some very big changes that have happened in our congregation. In particular, the change in our worship schedule. And I don't know about you, but I think that the kids at this congregation have done a really good job adjusting to that change. I think it's amazing the way that you can upset something that's been the way it has been for their entire lives, and yet they've managed to weather that very, very well. In addition to that, I think a lot of the lessons that I've been preaching lately have probably not really been up their alley. I don't know about your kids, but my five-year-old really doesn't care about the Dead Sea Scrolls and covenantal history all that much. Now, I know that we're in the midst of a lesson series on the Bible, the history of the Bible, the reliability and the credibility of its text, and its accessibility as well as a book to be applied today. But I thought we might interrupt that lesson series this morning by doing a lesson that might keep the attention of our kids a little bit better. Though, I will tell you that when I was putting this lesson together, even though I was looking for a topic that our kids might be really engaged with, I found that it was the adults that probably need this the most. So yeah, there's going to be elements of this lesson this morning that the kids are going to go, I know that, I get that, I understand that. But I think it's the rest of us, by the end of the lesson, who are going to really have something to think about. So bear with me, if you will, and I think if you're patient, you'll discover that this is not just a silly, superficial, cartoony lesson. I think you're going to find that you have something to think about when it comes to emotions. Now, there's a movie that came out recently. Probably a lot of you have already seen it, especially if you have kids. It was called Inside Out. And I will tell you, for a Disney, cartoony, fluffy movie, that was a pretty substantial hour and a half. I think if you've seen the movie, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you haven't seen the movie, I'm not any kind of representative for Disney Pixar. So I'm not telling you that you have to go see it or anything like that. But I think especially if you're a parent and you saw your kids growing up, if you're kind of in the middle of that right now, you're dealing with the emotional strain that comes along with being a kid today, the emotions that tend to fight with each other and conflict with each other, I think that that movie really spoke to you. Now, the kids like this movie because it's a colorful, bright, enjoyable, funny movie. But if you're a parent, and if you're a parent like me, then you had to hold back the tears for probably the entire second half of this movie. The basic premise of the movie is that inside this little girl's head are her primary emotions. And these emotions are personified in these cartoon characters that you see on the screen here. And these emotions tend to fight with each other. They don't tend to get along very well because all of them have they have a motive. They have a desire to be the dominant emotion inside of Riley's head. The emotion that seems to run the show most of all is joy, and the others, of course, you'll discover here throughout the rest of our lesson. Well, what I want to do with our lesson today is not just look at a Disney Pixar movie. I don't want to just talk about something cartoony or a pop culture reference. I really want to dig into the idea of emotions and the way that emotions do tend to fight with each other. And how is it that we're supposed to get our emotions all on the same page? How do we control our emotions, especially the more negative emotions like fear and anger and disgust? And how do we take those emotions from running our lives to where we're running them, and they become tools for our service to God? So let's start with the idea of the divine emotions, because all of our emotions do come from God. The reason why we're emotional beings is because Genesis chapter 1 very clearly says that we're created in the image of God. In His likeness we have been made. Now that doesn't mean that when you look at my face or your face in a mirror, or the fact that we have two arms and two legs or 10 fingers and 10 toes, that's what He means when we're created in God's likeness. God doesn't literally have fingers and toes. God doesn't literally have eyeballs as we understand eyeballs. God doesn't literally have hair or a beard or anything like that. Those are physical characteristics, and God is not a physical being. He's a spiritual being. So in what way then are we created in His image and in His likeness? I think what He's talking about there is the spirit, the emotions, the capacity to feel things, and to feel things that are beyond just a natural explanation, to feel things that are just that are beyond what the animals feel by instinct. Obviously, animals feel pain and animals have desires, but all those things are governed by their instincts. Dogs and cats and horses don't feel joy the way that we feel joy. They don't feel disappointment or frustration the way that we feel those things. They're not angry the way that we are angry, because in all of those emotions, we are emotional as God is emotional. And a great point to consider on that is that when it comes to emotions, God feels all of these emotions in His own divine way. When I think of my anger is like a tiny, tiny little version of His anger. Now, it's modeled after God's anger, but when I feel anger, I don't feel it necessarily as God feels it, because He feels a divine wrath, an anger that is greater than mine. And then the same is true then of the disgust. The same is true of joy. The same is true of sadness. God feels all of these emotions. We are modeled after them, but my version of that emotion is a smaller version of it. The other day, the kids and I went with Margie to go see the museum in Gilbert. If you haven't seen the Gilbert Museum, you need to go, and you need to ask Margie to go with you, because she knows all the secrets about it. She'll take you behind the scenes and let you touch all the 100-year-old farm implements. But one of the things there in the basement of the Gilbert Museum is the Model Railroad Club of Gilbert. Really, really neat display, by the way. Really, really neat display. But our emotions are almost like that model railroad. Okay? It looks like a house. It's shaped like a house. Okay? It looks like a little town. It looks like Main Street in Gilbert. It's a small version of the real thing. My anger and my disgust and my joy are modeled after God, but I feel them in a smaller way than Him. And there's several scriptures up here that I think give some background explanation of that. In particular, I want you to notice, if you have time to study a little bit more on your own, in Luke chapter 22 and verse 44, when Jesus is praying in the garden, the intensity of His emotions there. I have felt fear before, and I have felt disappointment in my brethren at times, and I have felt anxiety, and I've also felt relief from danger. But I don't think that I have ever felt any of those things as intensely as Jesus did when He felt that full range of emotions in the garden the night that He was betrayed. The trouble with emotions is that we're often very, very terrible at controlling them, unlike God, who has a just and righteous character that never fails Him. Where we feel angry, and sometimes that anger gets out of control, God's anger never gets out of control. Where we sometimes have anxiety or disgust or fear or joy, when it comes to the ministry of Jesus and His time spent in an earthly body, Jesus was never out of control with those things. When you see Jesus turning the tables over of the money changers in the temple, that was not Jesus out of control. And again, Jesus feeling anxious in the garden the night He was betrayed, that wasn't Jesus being out of control. That was the just and perfect and righteous character of God on display in the emotions of Jesus, the Son. God's righteous character never fails Him. So when He does feel angry, and when He is disappointed, and when He is joyful, or when He is sad, His character stands alongside him during all of those things. He feels emotions perfectly and sinlessly, whereas we do not at times. The thing about emotions is that we need to be very, very cautious with them. We need to be very careful not to be governed by our emotions, that our lives are not run by our emotions. Anger is a natural response to some of the things that we see in this world, but our lives should never be dictated by anger. I naturally feel disgust when I see things in this life. Sometimes I'm disgusted by the right things, and other times I'm disgusted by the wrong things. My life should never be dictated by my disgust. Fear is a natural response to certain kinds of stimulation. But my life, like other emotions, cannot be run and dictated by my fear. We need to be very, very careful because our emotions can sometimes bring us to ruin when they're not governed by God's will or when one of them dominates the others. Go to Proverbs 14, verse 30. In Proverbs 14 and verse 30, I like the balance that's supposed to be struck here of not going to the extreme when it comes to your emotions. He says in Proverbs 14 and verse 30, "A tranquil heart is life to the body, but passion is rottenness to the bones." And I take that passion to be a very general kind of passion. It's the kind of passion that's expressed in any emotion. When your anger goes too far and you have this very passionate expression of your anger, well, we call that a bad temper. And I think the passion can also be seen in a very passionate fear and in a very passionate kind of disgust. And sometimes even in a very passionate kind of joy that is not tempered by the wisdom of God. Passion is rottenness to the bone. When your emotions are running the show, when you're just a hot-tempered person who is governed by your passion rather than wisdom or discretion or morality or God's will covering all of those things, that's rottenness to your bones, and your life can be destroyed because of those things. In Galatians chapter 5, here in the context of Galatians chapter 5, notice what he says here beginning in verse 20. In Galatians chapter 5, these are the deeds of the flesh. He says in verse 19 that they are evident. And of those deeds of the flesh, one of them in verse 20 is jealousy. Another one is strife. Another one is outbursts of anger. You think that's the passion that's rottenness to the bones back in the book of Proverbs? Outbursts of anger, dissensions and factions, envying. What is envy? Envy is simply your emotions running the show. It's the emotions taking over. And things like these, he says, things like these, of which I forewarn you, just as I forewarned you, that those who practice such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. So at this point, you might be thinking, oh, a sermon about emotions. That's kind of fluffy. Who needs to hear about a sermon about emotions? A lot of these deeds of the flesh are simply emotions run wild. And the Apostle Paul makes it very, very clear that when your emotions run the show and you have outbursts of anger and jealousy and enmity and strife, when your emotions are running the show and they are destroying your life, they're not just destroying this physical life of yours, they're also ruining your prospects for going to heaven. We kind of dismiss a bad temper, don't we? Like, oh, I'm just a hot-tempered man. It's just kind of how I am. Well, that hot temper of yours is going to keep you out of heaven. That hot temper of yours is going to keep you out of heaven. I like in Hebrews chapter 2 where it talks about how Jesus became like his brethren in all things so that he could experience this life as we do. But what's something that you realize from chapter 4 and verse 15? Jesus might have experienced everything in this life as we experience it, but Hebrews 4 verse 15 also says he did those things without sinning. He was sinless. And that gives me a lot of encouragement. It encourages me that Jesus could live as a human being with the full range of emotions, with the full range of experiences, and yet at the end of his life he was sinless. It means it is possible to be angry and not sin, like Ephesians 4 says. It is possible to be passionate about some things in the right context and not sin while doing it. It is possible to be joyful in a way that glorifies God, not just self or the flesh. These things are possible. I like in 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 6, in the chapter on love, what does he say there about love? Love does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. Which means the greatest of all the emotions, if you can really call love an emotion, because so much of love is our actions, but the greatest of all of these things between faith, hope, and love, the greatest of all of these things has to be within the context of truth. True joy, true love, cannot rejoice in unrighteousness because it rejoices in the truth. It is dictated by God. It is felt as God would have us feel. Now the kids are going to love this because we're going to introduce you to some of the characters from the movie Inside Out. But I want to make some applications as we go along. One of them is named Fear. We all know fear. We've all experienced it. We've all felt it before. Fear helps us identify situations that are dangerous. We need fear. We need to be afraid of some things. You need to be afraid of scorpions. And you need to wear flip-flops when you go outside to the garbage can. Okay? You need to wear flip-flops when you go outside. It's our fear that helps us recognize dangerous situations or things that are going to harm us. Things that are going to bring us to ruin. We have to have that fear. We need it. But fear is interesting because fear also has kind of an ebb and flow as you go through life. Right now, Bennett doesn't fear anything. Bennett, you could put Bennett on the top of a table and she'd walk right to the edge and fall down to the floor. She has absolutely no fear. She could see a scorpion and she'd try to eat it. She has no fear. But that's because she also has very little knowledge. The more we come to know things, the more we start to fear them, don't we? I know that might go against conventional wisdom, doesn't it? That you fear that which you do not know. But I think that babies, people who are ignorant, I think they prove that you really don't fear the things you don't know. If you don't know what they are, if you don't understand them, if you're ignorant, well, you're going to walk off the edge of the table or find yourself eating scorpions and going to the emergency room probably. But I think sometimes the more we get to know them, the more we start to fear them. The more knowledge we gain, the more we become afraid. Which is why at the end of our lives, like it says in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 5, I want to note that verse actually, I want to get the wording right here because I like the way that Solomon describes it. And you know that Ecclesiastes chapter 12 is basically using symbolism and allegories to describe the experience of old age. But he says in Ecclesiastes 12 verse 5, furthermore, and again, this is in the context of growing old, men are afraid of a high place and of terrors on the road. That you almost get kind of to the end of life and everything starts to make you afraid. Because as your body becomes more frail, the more afraid you are of falling. I think we all understand that when we hear that somebody, so-and-so, fell and broke their hip, That's not just any run-of-the-mill broken bone, is it? So yeah, fear kind of ebbs and flows through life. It can be a very useful and even healthy starting point for our faith. Sometimes we think that we're not a very strong Christian because when we first became a Christian, the reason why we did it was because we were afraid of going to hell. Well, I didn't want to go to hell, so I became a Christian. And you know what? At first, that's actually a pretty good reason to become a Christian. In Luke chapter 12 and verse 5, he says, "But I will warn you who to fear. Fear the one who after he is killed has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him." But I think that eventually we have to move past that as our only motivation. That yes, fear can be a first and yes, immature response to the gospel message. But fear can't be the thing that sustains us through thick and thin in life. We can't go through life and have a relationship with God based only on fear. Revelation 21 verse 8 includes fear. The fearful or the cowardly as those who will have their place in the lake of fire in eternal judgment. So fear cannot be the thing that dictates our lives or runs our lives. We must eventually grow up to the point where courage is the thing that motivates us and not just fear. Now, this doesn't mean that I stop fearing God in the sense that I respect Him and respect His power, that I am indeed afraid of the power that He has to destroy the soul in eternal hell. But what it does mean is that I mature beyond the point of just being afraid of hell to where I want to serve God to make Him happy, where I want to serve God to please Him. In Romans chapter 8 and verse 15, when you read this passage here, you tell me, in Romans chapter 8 and verse 15, is the writer of Romans, is he just afraid of hell, or is there another dimension to his relationship with God here? For you have not received a spirit of slavery leading to fear again, but you've received a spirit of adoption as sons, by which we cry out, Abba, Father. There is much, much more to his relationship with God than just fear. But the next emotion that we find in the movie is disgust. Probably disgust is one of those difficult emotions because it's kind of an eye of the beholder type of emotion. What disgusts you might not necessarily disgust me. And all you have to do is say asparagus. Okay, and you understand what I mean. Now, for some of us, pull a little fresh garlic and some salt and olive oil and throw that asparagus on the grill. Now, that's a good night right there. But for other people, it doesn't matter what you can slather on all the butter and garlic on some asparagus, and there's people who still don't like it. Now, I don't get it. You're wrong about it. But there was a time in our lives where we hated asparagus, and we hated broccoli, and we hated all those things. But you know what? It's funny how the things that you hated when you were a kid, you almost kind of like you grow up and leave that behind, and you realize, you know, Brussels sprouts are pretty awesome. They are. Yes, they are. Don't shake your heads. They are. But disgust, I think it can seem like a very, very subjective emotion. So how is it then that I can discover if I'm disgusted by the right things? Because in the book of Romans, it says, abhor what is evil and cling to what is good, right? Abhor what is evil. How do I know if I'm disgusted by the right things? Well, I need to test my disgust by God's standard. And we're not just talking about vegetables or anything anymore. We're talking about real disgust. The real disgust, the kind of disgust that motivates us in life, the kind of disgust that helps us figure out what is right and what is wrong. In the book of Luke, I like in Luke 16 and verse 15. Notice with me, if you will, in Luke 16 and verse 15. You are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God. If I want to figure out what is the right thing to be disgusted by, what is truly detestable, I need to figure out what is detestable to God. Because Jesus is very clearly saying here that for some people of the world, they have some things that are highly esteemed. And those things are detestable in God's sight. Sometimes the things of the world that we pat ourselves on the back most for, good job, you won that award, you stood up for this cause, you believed in the right thing, those things end up being very detestable to God. I need to test my disgust, not by my own preferences, or not how I feel about something right now, because again, when you're 5, Brussels sprouts are detestable, but when you're 35, you discover they're actually not that bad. So what I need to do is figure out what is not detestable now to me by my standards and my preferences, but what is truly detestable in the eyes of an eternal and all-knowing God. And the comforting thing to me is that our sense of disgust can change, both for the worst. Remember in Jeremiah chapter 8 and verse 12, the prophet speaks by the power of God, you don't even know how to blush anymore. You have no idea how to be disgusted. You've reached a point in your spiritual degradation that you don't even know how to feel ashamed anymore. It's beyond your capacity now. But also we can change for the better. In Ephesians chapter 4, beginning around verse 20, in Ephesians chapter 4, we've been reading about the hardness of the hearts of the Gentiles and how that life is a life of depravity and self-destruction. But you did not learn Christ in this way, he says, if indeed you learned Christ at all. You changed. And the things that used to be glorious to you are detestable now. And the things that you didn't understand before are now the things you glory in. Which leads us to anger. The problem with anger is that it has a tendency to escalate and explode. And most of us lack the self-control to use it effectively. I like in Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 9. Ecclesiastes 7 verse 9 gives me a lot of encouragement. He says, "Do not be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools." And yet God is angry, isn't it? Isn't God angry? And doesn't he have the potential for incredible indignation? Yes, he does. Yes, he does. Read any of the minor prophets, and you'll see the indignation of God, and you will see that God is a God of great wrath, that God is a God of incredible vengeance. But God's anger doesn't justify ours when our anger is not controlled by his will. Sometimes we look at the anger of God and we kind of dismiss ourselves and say, see, God's an angry God, so that means I can be angry as well. But I think unless you're putting your anger to good spiritual ends, be angry, he says in Ephesians 4, yet do not sin, then you're wasting your time and you're wasting your anger. James chapter 1 and verse 19 encourages us to be very, very cautious when it comes to the use of our anger. In James chapter 1, beginning in verse 19, he says, "This you know, my beloved brethren, but let everyone be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. For the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God." The anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Now again, he's not saying that we can't be angry, that we should never be angry, that we're not allowed to be angry in certain contexts. He's saying the anger of man, when it is purely from your own heart, when you are angry because you don't like something, when you're angry because you don't like somebody, when you're angry because you didn't get your way, when your anger is motivated by self, by the man, that anger never accomplishes the will of God. That's very hard to do, isn't it? I think maybe one goal for us then, it's not a goal necessarily that we're really going to achieve, but I think you can set it as a goal for yourself. Why not just get rid of all anger? On the safe side. Just to be very, very careful. Because anger is the sort of thing like salt. You put just the right amount in and it might make a very, very good difference. But too much of it can really destroy a situation. Be very careful with your anger. Be very, very careful with it. Sadness is probably the most difficult emotion. It's our least favorite emotion. Nobody likes to be sad. We don't enjoy sadness. We don't look forward to an opportunity where we can be sad. Once you know what Schindler's List is about and you've seen it once, nobody goes and says, "I think I'm going to buy it on Blu-ray so I can see it all the time." We don't set ourselves up for sadness, on purpose at least. But the great thing about sadness, and you're thinking, there's a great thing about sadness? Yes, the great thing about sadness is that there's an incredible blessing that comes along with it. Why do you think Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 5, "Blessed are those who mourn"? Why does he say, "Blessed are those," in other words, who are sad? Because they'll be comforted. Sadness is terrible, but comfort is bliss. Comfort is wonderful. Comfort is awesome. But we have to go through sadness to get to that point, don't we? When we are comforted by others, as Romans 12 and verse 15 says, weep when others weep and laugh when others laugh. When we are comforted by others, what it does is it builds community. It builds stronger relationships. It builds character. It builds appreciation for other people. You are never as close to your family as when your family is facing a sad time. You are never as close to another person as you are when you open your arms and offer a grieving person a warm embrace. You're never as close to other people as when you're sharing sadness with others. And that's a blessing. We don't always see that blessing. We don't always want to accept or embrace it. But that's an incredible blessing. Read Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verses 2 and 3 sometime, and you'll find out that it is a more blessed situation to be in the house of the mourning than in the house of laughter. Which leads us to our last point, joy. Without sadness, can you really ever experience joy? I don't want to ruin the ending of the movie for you. I won't give you any details in particular, but one great lesson that you learn at the end of Inside Out is that you need sadness. Sadness is not something that you can just send off to the corner. Sadness is not something that you can just avoid. Sadness is not something that you can just sit there and wonder, what's the purpose of this? What's the point of this? Why is this even around? You discover, actually, that your most joyful experiences came because you went through a sad experience first. And if it wasn't for sadness, we might never really understand what joy is. In other words, if it wasn't for this life full of sadness, we might never understand what it means to be in the next life with God for joy. I know we're out of time here. Let me give you just a couple of applications here. We need to be very, very careful that when we talk about joy, we're talking about it in the right way. It's a lot like love, isn't it? We can come up with our own definition of love. We can come up with our own definition of joy, and those definitions might fit a worldly standard or a fleshly standard or a carnal standard. It might be convenient for us to see joy as playing video games or eating food or having a sexual relationship with just about anybody that we want. We might see those things as joy. They're not really joy. They're not true joy. Like in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 17 through 19, when you live by the flesh, when you live by the ways of the world, you never really experienced joy. You never really knew God. You weren't really happy. All you had was a delusion and a hard heart. That's all you ever really had. Joy, according to Galatians 5, verse 22, is a fruit of the Spirit. And how do you experience the fruit of the Spirit? We just read a few verses earlier in verse 16. You only get the fruit of the Spirit when you walk by the Spirit. If you're not walking by the Spirit, you will never experience the fruit of the Spirit. If you're not walking by God's standard and by God's will, and if you're not modeling your life after the life of His Son, Jesus Christ, you will never have the fruit of the Spirit. You'll never have joy. You'll never have peace. You will never have love. You will never have the real, substantial, meaningful version of any of those things if you're not first walking by the Spirit. Order your life after God, and God will fill your life with a treasure that cannot be measured in any earthly measurement. And joy also isn't the same thing as happiness. In C.S. Lewis's book, Surprised by Joy, he comes to an interesting realization. He says there that joy and pleasure are not the same thing. Pleasure is something that you have complete control over. If you want to feel physical pleasure, if you want to eat food and derive pleasure from that, if you want to play a game or play a sport or spend your money and buy stuff, those things can be physically pleasurable conditions. You have complete control over pleasure. But you don't have control over joy. Because joy doesn't come from buying things. And joy doesn't come from having sex with somebody. And joy doesn't come from eating food. That stuff doesn't result in true spiritual joy. Let me bring the lesson to a close on one last passage in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 through 9. 1 Peter chapter 1, and notice with me in verses 6 through 9. He says, "In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you've been distressed by various trials." And that's again that sadness and joy being two sides of the same coin. "That the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And although you have not seen Him, you love Him. And though you do not see Him now, but believe in Him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls." Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you will never experience the inexpressible joy of salvation. You must put on Christ in baptism when you believe that He is the Son of God. You must obey what Jesus Christ has said and embrace Him fully in the way that He has commanded. Whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.